occupation and blockade. Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes.
All Muslims are duty-bound to fight against the Zionist regime in an effort to maintain peace and stability in the Islamic world and the region, and stand firmly against expansionism and aggressive policies of Israel.
Mohammed al-Dura was martyred in the Gaza Strip on September 30, 2000, on the Jamal al-Dura and his 12-year-old son Mohammed were filmed by a Palestinian cameraman as Israeli forces fired bullets at them.
Israeli forces shot dead Mohammed al-Dura in his father's arms, but unfortunately the murderer enjoys support from his Western backers. The regime relieves itself from any responsibility for the support it receives from some governments, communities and international organizations. That's why it exerts organized violence against Palestinian society, especially children and the youth.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged three wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children. According to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. 19,000 minors, including children younger than 10 years of age, had been arrested since the outbreak of the Second Intifada back in September 2000.
To Palestinians, martyrdom of 12-year-old Mohammed al-Dura has become a symbol of resistance, which Palestinians believe is the only solution to put an end to Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Saman Kujrup, Tehran.
The farmers from Pakistan's most significant agriculture province of Punjab have been staging a sit-in since last week. The protest action is against the imposition of agrarian taxes and the increase of electricity tariffs by the government, which they say have badly hit their income.
The farmers who have been protesting since last week in Islamabad's Blue Area are asking the government to waive the taxes recently imposed on tube-well electricity and agriculture fertilizers.
Farmers are the backbone of the country's economy. We are demanding the restoration of the previous tube-well electricity tariff of ₹5.3 per unit and abolishment of all the taxes recently levied, as well as the other adjustments made by the government.
The farmers have warned that they will block off the main roads countrywide if their demands are not accommodated. They are also seeking an end to what they call black marketing of fertilizers and reduction of urea rate, which has risen to 400% in recent days.
The rates of urea and other key agricultural fertilizers have gone up in recent months. We cannot afford costs of harvesting our crops in such conditions. We demand relief funds from the government for the agricultural sector.
The government considers agriculture a provincial subject, so it refrains from addressing farmers' major issues. However, authorities are in contact with the relevant stakeholders to alleviate the farmers' concerns. The devastating floods, which have left more than 1,600 Pakistanis dead and displaced over 33 million people, have added to Pakistan's forex woes with an estimated economic loss of over $30 billion. Although the International Monetary Fund recently agreed to release over $1.17 billion in funds to Pakistan, the economic situation remains precarious in flood-hit country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The High School of Human Sciences Leonardo da Vinci is located in central Rome, not far from the Colosseum. The school has a good reputation. It offers a mix of classical and modern studies and a cultural background which, reads its website, allows pupils to access any university faculty. However, earlier this week, one of Leonardo da Vinci's teachers cut a lock of hair from an Iranian student after urging her to express solidarity with the protests taking place in Iran. The underage girl had remained unresponsive to the teacher's request.
con notevole sgomento.
We were shocked at the teacher's behavior. He targeted an Iranian minor because of her nationality and made the student feel that expressing solidarity was an act due for her. An act of exclusion from the class was then turned into an act of violence when the teacher humiliated the student by cutting a flock of her hair.
The teacher was addressing his pupils on the issue of protests in Iran that had been going on for days after the tragic death of 22-year-old girl Mahsa Amini. She politely refused to be interviewed, saying that Italy's education authority has forbidden all school staff from engaging with the media on the issue. The teacher involved in the case risks now a disciplinary sanction. Even the mayor of Rome, Roberto Gualtieri, has said the episode concerning the Iranian student, if confirmed, would be an unacceptable form of bullying.
Sicuramente c'è una violenza.
For sure there was violence in the way the teacher behaved. The whole story revolves around someone who has been bullied and their attacker. In between were the other students stunned, petrified, because of the teacher's gesture. They suddenly acted as if they were attendants. They were passive, resigned, a common attitude in our society.
The fact that a teacher, who is someone who should encourage free thinking and the natural reflection of wanting to do something for oneself, I don't know, I think it was absolutely unnecessary, and they should definitely face some consequences.
Also, the National Association of Principals of Rome has condemned the teacher's gesture, saying that teachers should always act with great caution and that principals must ensure that schools are a place of growth and not a place where one looks for media exposure. Max Civili, Rome.
Another black day for the residents of the west of Kabul. Today morning, a bomb hit the Kaj Educational Center in Dasht-e Barchi area in Sheikh Hazara neighborhoods. The students were sitting a practice university exam when the explosion went off. The victims of the incident were taken to the hospital. Their relatives report a high number of casualties.
My sister and my cousin were brought here to the emergency hospital. They are now in critical health conditions. They were at the educational center for their exams. As I witnessed, the victims were all innocent people. I saw nearly 60 to 70 people dead and wounded in one individual hospital.
Terrified Muhammad Issa has brought his wounded niece to this hospital. He calls on the Taliban and the global community to do something to help get rid of such attacks.
I saw a lot of people killed or injured. It was very shocking. I visited the educational center. Scores of bodies were laid on the floor. People are terrified. I don't know why there is no end to our suffering. They attack us everywhere. Till when? I call on the global community to do something for the situation of Afghan people, especially Hazaras.
Here, Taliban security officials are visiting the site of the explosion. They say they will take all necessary steps for tightening security for all.
Islamic Emirate is watchful for the security of the people, especially in western Kabul. I promise that everything will come under our control and such incidents won't happen in the future. Such attacks on innocent students are carried out by the enemies of Islam and the people of Afghanistan.
Mosques and educational centers in Sheikh Hazara neighborhoods in Kabul have been the target of terrorist attacks for years. The Daesh terrorist group have claimed responsibility for most of such attacks. People here in western Kabul say the seemingly endless violence has exhausted them. They want peace, security, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For many years, the people of Donbas have been waiting for this historic day, which was preceded by bloody war in the east of Ukraine that led to the intervention of the Russian army to save the Lugansk and Donetsk people from genocide. Despite Western pressure, the Russian president did not hesitate to accept the request of four regions of eastern Ukraine to join the Federation through a referendum described as successful by authorities in those regions. Central Election Committee representatives reported that those who took part in the votes decided overwhelmingly in favor of the accession to Russia.
The unbroken people of Donbas, Zaporizhia, and Kherson said the word. I want the authorities in Kyiv and the real masters in the West to hear me, and I want everyone to remember this. People living in DPR, LPR, Kherson, and Zaporizhia have become our citizens forever.
In a ceremony attended by the heads of Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions, Vladimir Putin signed a decree for the formal accession of the former Ukrainian territories controlled by the Russian army over the past months. As a result, the four regions became part of the Russian Federation, which is now obliged to protect them from any aggression under the constitution and the Russian military doctrine.
Today we're fighting for a just and free path. First of all, for ourselves, for Russia, for diktat, despotism to remain forever in the past. I am convinced that countries and peoples understand that a policy based on exclusivity of anyone, on the suppression of other cultures and peoples, is inherently criminal, that we must turn this shameful page. The collapse of Western hegemony that has begun is irreversible. And I repeat again, it will not be the same as before.
Our country is taking back its historical lands that our grandfathers defended. I am inspired that I caught and I am a participant of this moment. These territories and our people were artificially divided.
The West, led by the United States, has been supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine, sending large numbers of mercenaries to the country, and imposing huge economic sanctions against Russia. But it has failed to stop Moscow's special military operation in Ukraine. And for the Donbas, Zaporizhia and Kherson regions, which have been fighting for their right to become part of Russia, the accession means, first of all, security and sustainable economic development for them.
The right and decision of the four regions to join Russia is undoubtedly a historical moment. Moscow says strikes by Ukraine on those territories joining Russia today will be seen as an act of aggression against the state. It has vowed to protect the territories at all cost after their accession to Russia. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A recent report by the Pentagon says 12 civilians were killed in drone strikes during 2021 in Afghanistan. Two were killed in separate airstrikes in Herat and Kandahar, and 10 members of a family in a drone operation in Kabul just before the U.S. withdrawal. Although General McKenzie admitted that the incident was a mistake, but none of the U.S. military forces went on trial for this attack. The report also compares the number of casualties in 2021 and 2020. It shows there is a decrease, but those aren't the only years the U.S. was present in Afghanistan. The United States came to Afghanistan in 2001 and left the country in 2021. Armed drones were used by the U.S. military from the beginning. Still, there is no mention of the overall number of casualties in the report.
In recent years, the U.S. and the Taliban were negotiating and agreed that the U.S. reduces drone attacks, and that is why we witnessed a decrease in casualties during these two wars. This does not mean the Americans value human rights or have reduced errors and miscalculations in their operations. Drawing a comparison between these two years can't simply be a positive point for the Pentagon.
The exact number of casualties during the 20 years of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan is unknown, but the statistics show a 330% increase in the figure since 2017, when the U.S. military relaxed its rules of engagement for airstrikes in Afghanistan. Another source estimates more than 1,000 civilians have lost their lives in air raids, but that only includes the death toll from 2015 to 2020, which accounts for only 5 years of the U.S. presence. The survivors of U.S. attacks never received proper compensation, and no American troops were duly tried for their wrongdoings in Afghanistan. The reason, as stated most of the time, was that the investigations never found any violation of the law. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The moment when, via live link from a neighboring room, the Electoral Committee of Donetsk People's Republic announced to the press their intention to join Russia.
Colleagues, on the question raised for the referendum, do you support Donetsk People's Republic entering the Russian Federation by the rights of its subject is considered to be confirmed? I ask you to sign the protocol. It's a historical signature. I congratulate you.
These are historical days now. We are reuniting with our big motherland, Great Russia. Now we can breathe out, take a break for half a day, and continue creating, building, and repairing. But now we are not going to do it alone. Our brothers, our friends are with us now. I would like to thank every Donbass citizen. You are heroes.
Meanwhile, NATO countries have dismissed the votes as a sham. They say they are illegal under Ukrainian and international law. I put this question to Denis Pushilin moments after the result was made official.
Ukraine and NATO countries call this referendum illegitimate, and Russia is the only country so far to say that this referendum is legitimate. What do you have to say to those critics?
You know, once there was a time when Western countries didn't recognize the USSR. Our way is defined. The Western point of view was expected. Of course, we'll take into account their opinion, but we'll now act following the interests of our mother Russia.
Regardless of whether the West sees these referendums as legitimate or not, in the coming days, Russia will announce that these regions are now part of the Russian Federation, ushering in a new stage in the Russia-Ukraine war. Johnny Melodonetsk.
The World Bank, in its latest report on Afghanistan, has said that global food and energy prices continue to put pressure on basic household prices in the crisis-stricken country. At the same time, rising inflation and slow recovery in nominal wages have decreased the people's ability to buy basic goods.
Today, we witness people have lesser purchasing power. Previously, a middle-class household used to pay nearly $200 to buy multiple goods, but today they only ask for very basic necessities like oil and flour. You know, the prices are increasing. In addition, the banking crisis and sanctions have affected the prices and business in the market.
The World Bank report has confirmed that since June 2022, Afghanistan's currency has depreciated slightly against the U.S. dollar, while the prices of basic food and fuel items continue the upward trend. Abdullah Rizayi, who has been working as a shoemaker for almost half of his life, says he had never experienced such economic conditions before.
In the past years, I used to make sufficient income from this job. Currently, I'm not only receiving fewer customers, but the money that I earn has lost its value. I used to make 300 Afghanis per day, but nowadays I hardly can make 50, which is the price of 5 loaves of bread. Sometimes I feel ashamed when I look at my children.
In the meantime, widespread joblessness is leaving many Afghan families without a solution to make ends meet.
We have had a job once or twice a week in the spring and summer. I wonder why we should do it in the winter when there's no job to do. People are struggling with hunger and difficulties. Some have their own houses, but they should pay for the house rent too. This year, I fell short of paying the bills, and now I'm in debt.
This comes as the World Food Program has warned that Afghanistan is facing its most serious risk of famine in 20 years. The UN body has asked for $1.1 billion life-saving assistance for 18 million people across Afghanistan. The ripple effects of the U.S. sanctions and freezing of billions of dollars in Afghans' assets are pushing up inflation in Afghanistan. People here are calling for the release of assets and more international funding to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Donald Trump's coup attempt at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, got him banned from Twitter, which forced the former president to start his own social media company called Truth Social. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Matt Novak, writing for the website Gizmodo.com. The piece is titled, "Donald Trump Accidentally Admits to Crime in New Truth Social Post." Donald Trump's coup attempt at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, got him banned from Twitter, which forced the former president to start his own social media company called Truth Social. And the U.S. Department of Justice must be incredibly thankful that Donald Trump still has a way to talk directly with the American public, since the 45th president appeared to admit to at least one serious crime on Truth Social on Wednesday night, 31st of August. Trump's home in Florida was famously raided on Monday, 8th of August, after the Department of Justice and National Archives asked the former president for any classified documents he took from the White House, but only received a handful back. And late on Tuesday, a new court filing in the case included a photograph showing many of the highly classified documents the FBI found Donald Trump was illegally holding at Mar-a-Lago. Donald Trump tried to defend himself over the incident on Wednesday, 31st of August, sending out various messages on Truth Social that he apparently thought would exonerate him. But one message in particular contradicted his own legal team's court filings and seemed to be an admission of guilt for various crimes, including violation of the Presidential Records Act, and also obstruction of justice. Donald Trump's post on Truth Social on Wednesday night, 31st of August, read as follows. "There seems to be confusion as to the picture where documents were sloppily thrown on the floor and then released photographically for the world to see, as if that's what the FBI found when they broke into my home. Wrong. They took them out of cartons and spread them around under carpet, making it look like a big find for them. They dropped them, not me. Very deceiving. And remember, we could have no representative, including lawyers, present during the raid on Mar-a-Lago. They were told to wait outside." But why could this social media message be a huge problem for Trump? To start off with, it's a rather a blunt acknowledgement that Donald Trump not only knew he had classified documents in his possession in violation of the Presidential Records Act of 1978, but that he also knew where they were and how they were stored. And several lawyers made this point on Twitter. Trump now whines that the documents weren't on the floor like that. They took them out of cartons, he said. How does he know where they were stored, asked Tristan Snell, a lawyer who previously worked prosecuting Trump's fraudulent Trump University when he was with the New York Attorney General's office. If Donald Trump knew he still had classified documents, that would be at odds with a sworn statement from Trump's legal team that everything had already been handed over. The name of Trump's legal representative who swore to that claim is redacted in the court filing. The government's court filing also said the classified documents were likely concealed and that efforts were likely taken to obstruct the government's investigation. And Donald Trump never even bothered to argue against that point. The other thing about Trump's new Truth Social post makes clear is that these documents couldn't have been planted by the FBI, an allegation that has been made repeatedly by Trump supporters on Fox News Channel and on Newsmax and elsewhere. The idea that documents could have been planted isn't impossible, as we've seen plenty of videos showing police officers planting drugs in recent years, thanks to the advent of body cameras. But let's take the drug analogy further. Imagine Trump had been accused of holding heroin at Mar-a-Lago. Replace the word documents with heroin needles, and you can see that Trump is admitting he knew exactly where they were and how they were organized. There seems to be confusion as to the picture where heroin needles were sloppily thrown on the floor and then released photographically for the world to see, as if that's what the FBI found when they broke into my home. Wrong. They took them out of cartons and spread them around on the carpet, making it look like a big find for them. They dropped them, not me. Very deceiving. The problem for Trump becomes much more clear now, as anyone with a little bit of common sense can see. The other crime that Donald Trump could potentially be charged with is violating the Espionage Act. It's entirely possible that Trump was showing these documents to visitors at Mar-a-Lago, or in a more nefarious possibility, selling the documents to foreign governments. There's already evidence that Trump's son-in-law received $2 billion from the Saudi government, and no one really knows what the Saudis got in return for their cash. It certainly wasn't a smart investment, according to just about everyone involved. But Trump's lawyers don't seem too concerned with charges of espionage. In fact, they're calling the law mundane. They say themselves in these papers that they filed that this is under the Presidential Records Act, Trump lawyer Alina Haba said on Charlie Kirk's podcast on Wednesday, according to the Daily Beast. So what they did was try to criminalize Donald Trump, as they always do. They found these three mundane statutes, espionage and the other two, obstruction of justice. And they're trying to claim there is some sort of criminal activity, Alina Haba said. Another defense of Donald Trump's actions has been that he declassified all of these documents, but it's unlikely that will hold up in a court of law. For one thing, the president can declassify almost any document that he wants, but not some of the most closely held nuclear secrets. And there have been reports from the start that at least some of these Mar-a-Lago documents held nuclear secrets. But even if you want to believe that Donald Trump somehow declassified these in his head, as some of his lawyers have tried to argue, that's not how it works. The president has to declare documents declassified, and then they get marked with a line striking through the top secret notation on each page. Anyone who's received formally classified documents through the Freedom of Information Act is familiar with what this looks like. None of the documents in the photograph taken by the FBI at Mar-a-Lago show markings that indicate anything there was declassified. There was a reasonable argument that Donald Trump needed to get booted from Twitter because of his neo-fascist language to supporters was a threat to the safety and security of the United States. But at this point, Trump's social media activity could reasonably force the hand of a Department of Justice that's clearly uneasy about making the unprecedented move of charging a former president with a crime.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It appears that the Yemen truce is at a dead end. Not only have the Ansarullah movement made that announcement, the fragile truce, which was broken by the Saudi-led coalition many times, has now ended without it being renewed, despite attempts by UN envoy Hans Grotenberg to extend it. Why would this ceasefire end? Why is there a lack of political will to end this conflict? Is it because the Saudis have not budged, especially when it comes to their chokehold of the port city of Hodeidah? Just a couple of the questions that we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our correspondent from Sana'a, Yusuf Mari, in order to get the latest coming on this. Yusuf Mari, the way that this truce was announced for it to have ended came from the Ansarullah on the one hand, where they said that it has reached a dead end. But then when you read the news, one particular piece of news that said the U.S. State Department has said that Anthony Blinken welcomed Saudi Arabia's commitment to extending the Yemen truce just yesterday. It kind of sends a conflicting report on this in terms of whether it has ended or not.
That's a good point you bring up. In point blank, Saudi Arabia has welcomed the extension of the ceasefire agreement. However, the Sana'a government is rejecting the current structure of the extension of the ceasefire agreement. Look, you know, since the ceasefire was announced 6 months ago, Ansarullah, the Sana'a government has been very clear. This is just a ceasefire to see if political negotiations can take place to reach the ultimate end, the ultimate goal, which is to completely lift the strangling blockade on Yemen, to open Sana'a International Airport, and to ensure that government salaries are paid to all government employees. And Ansarullah presented it as a precondition that by the time the ceasefire ends, if these main demands are not met, they will not commit to any extension of any ceasefire agreement that employs the strangling blockade, that continues the blockade on Yemen, that continues the blockage of roads, that refuses to pay Yemeni government salaries, their monthly salaries. And under the current structure of the ceasefire agreement, Sana'a International Airport remains very limited, which means that, you know, you can only fly in and out of Sana'a Airport from Sana'a to Amman, Amman to Sana'a, and from Egypt to Sana'a and Sana'a to Egypt. These are the only two countries where Yemeni flights are allowed to depart from and to land. So this is not according to what the Ansarullah movement see as a just extension of a ceasefire agreement or any peace deal for that matter. And the Ansarullah movement's leadership, they've been very clear that by the time, by October 2nd, if the ceasefire agreement does not meet the demands of the Yemeni people, they will take military preparations. They will not hesitate to use their ballistic missile capability, which they have displayed over the past month or so, which featured a number of advanced military equipment such as armored vehicles, ballistic missiles, which we have not seen before, which have not been presented, and which the Saudi coalition did not expect the Yemeni armed forces to be in their disposal. So 3 hours after the ceasefire agreement ended, with at 6 p.m. Yemen Sana'a time, there hasn't been any aerial bombardments in the capital Sana'a, or for that matter, there hasn't been any aerial attacks from the Ansarullah movement into Saudi territory. However, what I can tell you is that there has been a couple of reports of sporadic fighting taking place on a couple of battle fronts, which is an indication that the fighting on the ground has somewhat resumed in some parts of the country.
Thank you very much for that, Yusuf Mari. Appreciate it. Of course, one of them from Sana'a. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Firas Al-Najim, human rights activist, joins us from Ottawa. Also joining us is Said Mohsin Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Said Mohsin Abbas, let me first start with you. We just asked a correspondent about the different perspectives that is being looked at when it comes to this truce. And the point that's being made here is that as far as the Ansarullah is concerned, it's reached a dead end and that the ceasefire has actually expired. But yet you have the U.S. That has said it welcomes the extension of the truce by Saudi Arabia. So they think that that the status quo during the ceasefire, which led to nothing, is okay for it to continue, at least based on what our correspondent there said. But there's a point to be made here. Why hasn't there been a political will by the Saudis in particular, or the Saudi coalition, to reach some kind of solution, compromise, or what have you?
It's a completely perplexing situation. The Saudi Arabians really don't benefit from this war in any substantial way. They're not huge international geopolitical players, so they don't really gain from trying to get hold of the Bab al-Mandeb Straits, which has a huge international shipping, influence and a vital strategic, role there. They don't benefit even from the Socotra Island, which is, again, another part of that waterway going past Yemen, which ultimately doesn't really benefit the Saudis. The Saudis have oil of their own. They haven't got a shortage of oil. So the little bit of oil that Yemen did have, in Hadramaut, for instance, doesn't really equate to something that's going to change the Saudi economic situation in a huge way. The Yemenis weren't threatening Saudi sovereignty in any way. They simply had an internal, of course, dispute going on about who should rule the country. And it was the Saudis who were obviously, along with the Americans, controlling puppet governments. And that puppet government wasn't delivering anything which was really beneficial for Yemen in the long run. And that's where the trouble really began. So, first of all, in answer to the question of the Saudis' benefit, they have no benefit. So who does benefit? Well, it's certainly the Americans and the Western powers were far bigger interests in controlling the Bab al-Mandeb Straits. It's they who have an interest in locking down that southern tip of Arabia for whatever military, geostrategic, future maritime, economic reasons they have. So in a sense, the Saudis are a proxy for a war which really only benefits the Zio Western Empire. Now, to add to the woes of the Yemeni people, even when Ansarullah do go into these truce arrangements with Saudi Arabia, it's happened time and time again, what ends up happening is that Saudis continue their air bombardments. They continue with air raids that essentially knock out hospitals. They target schools. They target marketplaces. They target waterworks, resulting in cholera and famine and all sorts. And worse still, now they're also preventing things like even mine clearance, which I'll come on to perhaps in the next part of my
we'll get to that definitely. I need to ask you, Feroz Al-Najim, if we do a check on as to why the ceasefire came into place in the first place. If memory serves me right, you had the Ansarullah achieve successes on the battlefield many times over, and one of the major the restrictions placed upon the Saudis were the attacks with the ballistic missiles by the army onto the Saudi Aramco oil facility. So the Saudis were forced at that point to basically bend and agree to a ceasefire. Why would they then not proceed during the ceasefire that has been renewed so many times now to move towards some kind of political solution so that they don't come again under the offensive by the Ansarullah movement?
Yes, I mean, they didn't do this. They didn't, you know, start the ceasefire or sign it, you know, out of goodwill. Like you said, it was because Ansarullah, you know, the Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi and his army, the Yemeni army, obviously, you know, were striking hard inside Saudi Arabia and hitting very important areas, you know, that have to do with their economy. And, you know, it was a big threat to them, you know, so they did a lot of attacks in Riyadh as well. So this they were extending and expanding their attacks against the Saudi regime. And it was dangerous for them at that time. So they wanted to kind of calm things down. And the ceasefire is not really helping in many ways. It's just, you know, there's not much bombardments, let's just say, and war, actual battles on the ground. But at the same time, you know, this embargo is, and this they're trying to choke the Yemeni nation, and many things cannot get inside the nation that are like they need them, especially in hospitals, medical supplies, many things that are not available for the Yemeni people. And now with the inflations that are hitting the whole world because of the war with Ukraine and so on. So, you know, they delay these processes to actually come down to a real resolution. And the reason why is because Saudi Arabia doesn't have sovereignty, and they don't have control of what really to do and how to change things. The thing is, the U.S. is behind this, and the U.S. will not compromise and sacrifice Bab al-Mandab when they know that Hormuz, you know, is in the hands of the Iranians, at any time they can choke that area, that apart and close it down and stop any shipments and any kind of way for any Americans or any of their puppet regimes to move anything in that area. So if Bab al-Mandab is also choked, that means the whole Middle East is in the control of the axis of resistance. And this is what's their real fear. This is why they will not stop this war. Because stopping this war means Ansarullah becomes legitimate, becomes credible, becomes open to opening relations with other countries, and they can start to import weapons, they can start to import security materials, they can strengthen their control of that area. And they know that Ansarullah, their focus and their main goal, as they always speak about, is that they want to liberate Palestine and they want to secure and save the Palestinian people.
Well, this is what's confusing. I mean, you have 6 months of these, if negotiations were taking place, I'm sure they were in one form or another. But the Ansarullah has come out accusing the Saudi-led coalition, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, of stalling, saying that, you know, you guys didn't even help alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. You're still chokeholding and laying a siege on the port city of Hodeidah. You're not letting humanitarian goods, at a minimum, be able to cross on and trickle down into the land and reach the people. So is this announcement by the Houthis, I'm sorry, by the Ansarullah movement, that it has reached a dead end, this reason,
because they
haven't reached any kind of compromise on that?
I think the Saudis are playing games. As their masters in the background, the Israelis and the Americans, don't want any kind of real cessation of war. There's no solution to this this dispute, this situation, through military means for neither a party. At the end of the day, only a diplomatic and political solution can be a real, you know, game changer and something which would conclude this war. But it's quite clear that it's not in the interests of the Zio Western Empire to stop this war. And let me give you some examples of why. Number one, they're making money out of this. Look, for instance, let me just put the State Department's approval of about $30.1 billion of arms contracts for Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Lockheed. I could roll off the list of, you know, military, you know, industrial arms complex fraternity that have gained huge amounts of money from this. What's more, they also get to test these weapons on poor people in Yemen. You know, all the testing of this kind of firepower, which needs to be done, also is part of the game. And the result is that then it becomes a race amongst all of these kind of very, very inhumane Western so-called secular democracies. Because please note that just this week, Germany has begun to also supply weapons, even though in 2018 it put a ban saying that it was against their policy to supply conflict zones with arms. Well, they've just done a deal with the Saudis, the UAE, etc., and they too are now up for supplying. I think Germany has approved a new range of arms exports.
Right, it did. Why did it do that?
Make it worse.
Why did it do that? Is that a signal of something coming up in terms of perhaps Saudi Arabia wanting to come throw itself back into the heat of the war again? Is that why Germany perhaps renewed? I mean, Germany came out and said in December, Seamus and Abbas, that the new government coalition, that government came into place. They said, we're not going to sell any arms to Saudi Arabia. That wasn't that long ago. So what happened?
What you can appreciate is that since then, Ukraine and the war in Europe has kicked off. Now, what's happened is the Germans, the first violation of that rule that they made was in supplying weapons to Ukraine. So that's opened the floodgates. And of course, this is what the Americans have maneuvered the Germans and the European nations into, the militarization. So Germany is compelled to do this. Actually, it's with a joint program with Italy, Britain and France. They're not doing it on their own. This is the increase of this arms supply to Saudi, which will perpetuate the war in Yemen, is coming from all of these European nations. Sure. And America, the one behind it.
First, on Najim, back in September of 2022, not that long ago, about a month and a half. I don't know if you watched this huge military parade and display by the Yemeni army. I mean, it was quite spectacular. And what it did, it caught many by surprise because of the depth and the volume, not only in terms of the personnel, but also the awesome military equipment that was on display, from tanks to drones to what have you. So we're seeing that. And at the same time, we're looking at how Saudi Arabia perhaps is viewing that, along with this coalition, whatever's left of it. So it signaled that they had entered another military playing field by that display, the Yemeni army, that is, which means that this war, if they were to continue, it would be a different type of war for them. Do the Saudis realize that? Did they interpret that awesome display of power the way that the Yemeni army did?
I mean, the Saudis in history have, you know, they were stuck and trapped inside Yemen, and they lost. And many people have lost in history because Yemen is known to be the graveyard of the invaders. You know, in Arabic, they call it Maqbarat al-Ghuzat. So the Yemenis are known to be, you know, warriors, that they defend their country, they care about their sovereignty. They won't be submissive to any colonial powers that try to take control. And this is just one show in this era right now, showing how with this huge blockade, with all this bombardment, this huge coalition, and many mercenaries that were bought. You know, there was, you know, many organizations or companies that were involved in this. There was many governments that were bought out, such as Sudan, former government of Sudan, you know, Omar Bashir, when he was in power. They went out and bought out people. They just, you know, whatever country was suffering, they told them, okay, bring your army and we'll pay you money. We'll help you with your financial issues and then get inside Yemen. And they all lost inside Yemen. And the Yemenis were able to, you know, capture all these different soldiers from different countries and humiliate them on TV and show, you know, that we caught the Sudanese soldiers, we caught these kind of soldiers. And it was a major loss and humiliation for all the world. You know, this logistical support is being given by the UK, France, and USA. These are the three main powers that, you know, expanded their colonial and control of a lot of the world. And they cannot deal with this poor nation of, you know, determined people. So it shows that the Yemenis are now in a very high stage and high level. They're very advanced. Their weapons are actually advancing. And I think the axis of resistance is helping them somehow. You know, it's either just by giving them support, giving them information, you know, it's consultation, things like that. But the rest is all Yemeni hands, Yemeni brains, Yemeni determination. And the Yemenis have proven to the world that nobody can break their will, nobody can break their unity, nobody can break their government. You know, it's an amazing nation, honestly, compared, and it's a very good, amazing example to the world that you cannot break people's determination if they're united and they're oppressed.
So, Mohsen Abbas, so trying to figure out here what game plan the Saudis have and the coalition. I mean, after the question that I asked about the display of the military might of the Yemeni army, you really can't compare it to what they were, even though from what they were with what they had at hand previously, they were able to, in a sense, bring about that truce because they almost defeated the Saudi-led coalition in so many ways. So what could be in the Saudis' mind at this point if, indeed, this has ended, this truce, or are they going to try to claw their way back into a truce with the Ansarullah movement?
Well, it could be that the deep state, the Israeli and the American deep state, have convinced the Saudis that, look, if you go for it, we're going to perhaps supply you with even more, as Donald Trump put it, shiny weapons to actually milk the Saudis. That's what the Americans are doing, even under Biden. Maybe they managed to persuade the very unwise Saudi leadership. I mean, look, the reality is that Saudi has been given the olive branch several times, even by the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance axis. And they have sensibly said, look, even the Hope initiative was designed to say, look, let's solve our regional problems ourselves. Let's not resort to bringing in America, bringing in, you know, the Western powers, because that only exacerbates the problem. The Saudis, unfortunately, for many, many decades, if not from their inception, have been part of an Anglo-Zionist imperialist, guarantee in that region to continue the trouble, to continue division, to continue sectarian and religious hatred, and to supply the likes of ISIS, Al-Qaeda. Will Saudi change that attitude? Do they have the power to do it? No, I don't think so. You saw that as soon as bin Salman came in, he immediately stamped his foot down, and even the top layer of the Saudi monarchy, if you like, and the family of al-Saud were virtually incarcerated. They were locked up in huge, expensive hotels until they coughed up with the money that they needed to sign off whatever bin Salman wanted or Mohammed bin Salman.